Welcome to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com.
Good afternoon and thank you for joining us today. I'm here with David Burt, the Leader of the Opposition and the Shadow Finance Minister. Mr. Burt, thank you very much for sparing some time today to do this interview.
Thank you very much. I understand it's our first time doing a live interview, so hopefully we'll be okay.
We're live together for the first time. Where did it all start? Tell me something about David Burt that I and nobody else knows.
I think that, I don't know if it's you or nobody else knows, but I am the youngest of, I would say, six children. I'm the only child of my parents, however, and I went to military school, so I know how to fly a plane, I can march, I can do drill, I can do all those things, and I am a computer nerd, so it was very
interesting.
It was very interesting that earlier today I was speaking to students at Berkeley, and one of the students asked if I was in high school. I was on the debate team, and I actually thought it was kind of nerdy that I said that I actually, when I was in high school, I did programming contests. So we literally went into a room and we programmed. So that was like our big competition. So
you don't look like the typical techie nerd.
Typical techie nerd? Well, I guess I'm forced in that way. But if you find me around some code and all the rest, I will sit there all night with my business partner and we will write codes.
You mentioned you went to military school. Mm-hmm. But here you are, the leader of a Labour left-wing party. Mm-hmm. Where did that come from?
Where the military school?
The belief in Labour in the left of centre politics. It doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. equate in people's minds, perhaps, mm-hmm. that military school would mm-hmm. mean that you'd end up the leader of a left wing party.
I got you. Well, I mean, military school was more about learning how to fly. The funny thing is that I didn't actually know it was a military school until I went there. Yeah. I just literally thought that I was going to high school and would go to class in the morning and in the afternoon we would fly planes. And I went at the age of 11. And of course, you can't actually begin to fly planes for real until you're about 15 or 16 years old. But my mom made the decision to send me out of Bermuda when I was in elementary school. My mother sent me to Saltus, and that was a very interesting experience. And I spoke about that experience a lot with people, especially because I actually left Saltus thinking that I was dumb. And I remember there were lots of different experiences. I will never forget the time that I was, it was fifth grade, and a certain teacher, I remember I finished, I was always good at math, I was always good with numbers, and I remember I had finished first in my class, and the teacher had asked me, when I turned in my paper, the teacher had asked me, who did I copy off of? And I proceeded to say something, and then it was sent out of class. But I mean, the environment there at that time, I mean, we're talking about... fix my mic. The environment at that time for young black males, I don't think was the most conducive environment. I don't know about the environment right now, but I think that I remember the principal at the time had actually advised my mother to take me out of that school, and it was probably the best decision I made.
So is that what led you into sort of your politics? Did that give you a grounding? I'm just wondering how you got from Saltus Military School mm-hmm. to the leader of the Labour Party.
Well, what I would say is that my family is Labour. My family is workers, and I think that that's the most important thing. The question is what the Progressive Labour Party has stood for. The Progressive Labour Party has always stood for workers. It's always stood for the less fortunate. It's always stood for those who are downtrodden and don't have a voice. And that has always been where my politics has been. And I think right. that's where, as a country, or sorry, not as a country we need to be, I certainly believe that. Mm. But I think that that's what the best of politics needs to represent. The persons who have a voice, the people who are well-to-do, don't necessarily need someone fighting for them. They already have things in their corner. And I think that that's the view of a Labour Party. Our Labour Party roots come from the struggle in Bermuda. We understand that the Progressive Labour Party was, by and large, born out of the union movement, and that's where we are. And we recognize those links, and those links, I think, are incredibly important because there are still challenges this day that we face insofar as whether it be labor and or workers, and making sure that persons who may not have all the means are able to be successful.
So do you draw from any particular ideology?
Well, the ideology that I draw from, I mean, a lot of people will joke, but I I don't want to say that it's like middle of the road. I don't want to go so far as to say third way with Tony Blair and all the rest.
That's a collection of ideas rather than an ideology. But
Well, that's fine. But I mean, from an ideological perspective, I don't hone to ideology. I'm more of a, I would say, a practical person. I more deal with, pragmatism. It's a question of what works as opposed to the ideology. I mean, there are things that work that might be that people will consider on the right tail and people on the left. But I think that government overall should be looking out for those people who cannot look out for themselves. I believe that government has a responsibility to take care of those people who cannot take care of themselves, and government has a responsibility to make sure that we provide the opportunity for citizens to advance. So if there's an overall ideology, that's where it is.
I suppose the ideology there is a collectivism, isn't it? You believe in the collective rather than the individual.
Certainly, and without question, and I absolutely believe that government has a role to play, and I think that as a society, we should work together to promote aims. So I would say that, yeah, that would work.
You were first appointed as a junior minister in November 2010. So your hands-on political experience, I know you were chairman of the PLP before that, your hands-on experience is quite short. What makes you, in that context, qualified to lead the country?
And that's an excellent question. I feel as almost the questions I had earlier when I was speaking to students at Berkeley have almost prepared me for this because they were similar in nature, and I think that that's something that's very important. I think that it's right now it's the question of the experience of the Progressive Labour Party, and it's the question of the leader of the Progressive Labour Party. There's myself, yes, insofar as leading the country, but there's also a team, and what we're looking to do is we're looking to establish and put together the best team to run the country. Insofar as myself personally becoming the leader of the country, it's an awesome responsibility. It's something that when I go home in the evenings and I speak to my wife, I'm still trying to adjust to the change between now being opposition leader and leading our party into an election. But I think that at the same point in time that certain people will question the experience, I think in other times that the lack of experience, the limited experience I have has possibly not had me set in ways which may, put people in a very firm position. I happen to think that we can be flexible. I happen to think that a lot of times in politics, especially sometimes in almost Westminster-style politics, we'll adhere to a certain position and we won't be flexible. And I think that my relative short time in politics means that I have not possibly set into these very reflexive ways, which I think may also be a burden as much as it is for some people who think that it's a strength.
So the two things I take from there, that it seems like if you think the idea is good enough, you will draw it from the right of centre politics as well as left of centre politics, as long as you think the idea is good enough. And the other thing is you do admit that there's a certain amount of inexperience. So on two questions, I suppose it's more of a statement, but the question at the end of it is, how are you going to convince people of your inexperience? You've admitted your inexperience. How are you going to persuade people that you've got the experience necessary? And so much of this nowadays in politics is to do with personalities of the leader. So if the leader comes across as being inexperienced, how are you going to persuade them otherwise?
Well, when it comes to the question of experience, I would say that from my view, I don't believe that I am inexperienced. I believe that my experiences in life, the experience of which I've been through in life, have taught me a lot. I also believe that I think that, and it almost goes back to something of which you said insofar as collectivism, I know that's more of an ideology and a view of government, but it's also the leader of the country is not the one that's making all the decisions. And I want to, I said in my throne speech reply, I want to change the way that government works, for government to be more participatory, for more people to have a say, for government to be more transparent, and those type of things. I believe that, in my view, the more persons that are contributing to the way in which the country works and operates, the better decisions that we have in the end. I don't believe that individuals and parliaments, and sorry, not individuals, but cabinets, should be the sole decision-making bodies of the country. They're the ones who are responsible for the executive. But if there are ideas that can come from both sides, and if parties can not only work together, but come up with plans that can be supported from both sides, there are also plans that will have a support of the majority of the country, and that means that they will be successful in so far as they're implementation and going forward. Because Bermuda being so small of a country, when we talk about the traditional right politics, when we talk about the left politics, you're talking about picking ideas from certain places. Things which may work on a traditional social sense in a large country like the United States or the United Kingdom may not work here. No, and we need to make sure that we have the solutions that work inside of Bermuda.
It's kind of interesting. We could dwell on this quite a long time, because to me that's talking about pluralism.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great debate. You've got lots of isms, Jeremy. I've got lots of isms. Deaconisms.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of debate as to whether pluralism actually works or not, but maybe we'll have that discussion for a cup of coffee one day. We've had a pretty dramatic week of news. Unfortunately, there is something that has overshadowed all that today.
Mm-hmm.
And we woke up this morning, all of us, to realise that another young person has died at a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what would the PLP propose to do to try and get on top of and stop this gang issue, and in particular the use of weapons?
Mm-hmm. I think the first thing in which we have to realize that it's more than a law enforcement and crime issue. It's a social issue, and it's a question of what are the social conditions which have led to the situation where young men, and it's basically young black men who feel that they have little regard for life, and that disagreements should be solved with a bullet as opposed to resolving conflict in less violent ways.
Mm.
The young man who was deceased, I knew him. The young man who's deceased, this morning I spoke to the young man's son's mother, and she had a very difficult experience this morning, because it was her job to wake up and to tell her son that he would never see his father again. And there are, and I understand that the young man's mother is disabled, and the son was her caretaker. And so not only is a son without a father, a mother is without a son, there are lots of people that are hurting, and these things have played out over and over and over again in our society, and they seem to continue.
So what's your answer?
But from my perspective, we have to address these social challenges, and we have to understand that a lot of these things come from not only the lack of opportunity, not only the feeling in Bermuda that amongst black men, there are lots of places where they cannot be successful, and a lot of places, and sometimes the only place where they can feel a sense of worth and a sense of belonging is inside of a gang, and insofar as acting out in these violent ways. So we have to address the social side of the equation, and that means opportunity, that means jobs, that means training. I just had a meeting beforehand with David Lovell, who's doing work with men on a mission and trying to make sure that we can get skills and train young black men in skills that can help them succeed in life and life skills like that. So we have to focus on that side. The other thing which we have to realize, and we have to also address, are the contributing factors of whether it be drug use and or drug abuse, whether it be alcohol that can inflame these situations, and we have to be open and honest. But my view is, overall, the solutions may come from politicians, but this, of course, is a community issue. And the view that I have is that, by and large, we have not done enough to combat the issues. So on a direct sense, it has to have as high a priority as with economic development. It has to have a higher priority as things of which we're dealing so far as the airport. It has to have that higher priority. And we have to give the clubs the support of which they need. I think community clubs have an excellent role to play.
Mm.
And when we talk about community clubs, the challenge of which we have community clubs right now is that community clubs themselves rely on alcohol sales.
Yes,
and when you rely on alcohol sales, sometimes those environments will lead to escalation, which we may not desire. So we have to be able to support them. And we also have to, as was mentioned inside of our throne speech reply, provide concrete opportunities through the Job Corps program and making sure that we provide young black men with the skills and the second chances that they need.
I think none of this is going to happen overnight.
None of this is going to happen
overnight.
It's
taken years to put
But from an enforcement perspective, I think that the police are doing a relatively decent job from an enforcement perspective. And the thing is that the challenge in which we face is by making this behavior unacceptable. And this type of behavior right now, it's almost idealized amongst young people. I have young people inside of my community who are 15 years old. I mean, if you look at the videos that are on YouTube, which are being put out by some of these groups of young men, they're just talking about, you know, killing. Like, that's the way they're growing up. And somehow, some way, we have to change that.
So why isn't that changing? Why isn't the community, or at least it appears like the community, isn't getting to grips with this themselves and saying this is unacceptable?
I think one of the things that we also have to confront is, in a small society, people are fearful. They're fearful. And in a lot of ways, then the leadership has to come so that people are not fearful. And I think that that's something that we have to deal with. But people are fearful, and people are fearful naturally.
But there doesn't seem to be a sense of emotion about it like there was over the airport.
Mm-hmm.
We see a march at the airport, we saw a march over immigration reform. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen a march over this. There isn't quite the same emotion about
it. I think that we've seen many marches on violence. I think that we have.
We've seen vigils.
We've seen vigils. I mean, we've seen marches. I mean, we saw marches back in 2009 and 2010 when all this first, when the gun violence really started to escalate. So we did see that. But I think that by and large, and this is a sad reality of the fact, is that people not only have become desensitized, but they've come to the fact of where it's something that is acceptable. And from our view and from the view which I'm looking at, that's why I said it's one of those things that we have to make less acceptable. And that means that persons who are perpetrating these things may not be welcome inside of society. We might have to get to the point where these persons are not welcome inside of establishments that sell liquor. We might have to get to the point where these persons are not allowed. And that's the type of thing we have to do. So the social behavior actually has consequences insofar as the interaction in society. And those are the things in the discussion which we have. And I think that I happen to believe that if, from a government perspective, if there was the high enough priority from a government perspective in working with not only the police but also the business community and the community clubs in putting those things in place and agreeing the measures that don't just happen in one club but that happen with all the clubs, I think that we can make progress.
I touched on the issue of the airport. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've seen an awful lot of news about that, an awful lot of headlines.
Mm-hmm.
Just before we talk about what actually happened and the fallout, the implications of that, can you try and explain to me and to all our viewers what the difference is between the airport PPP and the acute care wing of the hospital PPP?
There's a very simple difference between the two. With the hospital, there was a company that built the airport, and the Bermuda government manages and runs through the Bermuda Hospitals Board. So the Quango that the Bermuda government has manages the hospital. In the case of the airport, the Canadian company is going to build the airport, but the Canadian company is also going to run the airport for 30 years. So that is the difference. The one was a private-public partnership to build and maintain. This one is a private-public partnership to build, operate, and maintain. And the operational point is very key.
Understood.
Because that is all the revenue that comes from the airport will go to this company. And they will have control over the operation for 30 years. That is not the case with the hospital.
But if you look at the history of the hospital wing, mm-hmm. We look at the makeup of Paget Health Services,
mm-hmm.
which was the consortium that mm-hmm. won 14 companies, and at least five that I can see mm-hmm. are not based in Bermuda. So mm-hmm. all the money went out there.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a similarity with the airport operation?
It is a similarity if you want to put it in so far as if you were to borrow money and the people who are putting up the money for the borrowing of the money are overseas investors anyhow, and then you're repaying that and the money that they're making. So, I mean, we can put it the same way. The fact is that they do not operate the hospital. They
understood.
They built and constructed it, but they do not operate the hospital, and I think that is a very distinct point.
The maintenance, though, is contracted out mm-hmm. to a Canadian company.
The maintenance,
so that's again money going overseas.
I've got you, but when you go with a build and maintain model, there are arguments for going with the build and maintain model, and the arguments for going with the build and maintain model is that means that the company knows that they cannot short things on the construction side, you know, take shortcuts because they have to maintain it over the period of the contract. So those are the reasons why those maintenance things came in. So I can understand from the perspective of where you're saying, but I think that there is a very distinct difference when we're talking about the operation of the airport. If we were talking about it from the acute care wing perspective, that would mean that Bermuda Hospitals Board would no longer be owned by the government of Bermuda, mm-hmm. and it would be an independent company that is running the health care in the hospital.
One of your biggest criticisms is the money that goes overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And all the money from this is going overseas.
Mm-hmm. I would say that all the money from the operation of the hospital isn't going overseas.
Payments, debt payments are going overseas.
Well, if you were to borrow money to build anything in Bermuda, when the investment from the debt comes from overseas in mm. large aspects, but I think the challenge is, and I think that is an excellent point, why does the money have to come from overseas? We saw when the Bermuda government did a local bond and local Bermuda dollars, how quickly it was snapped up. Aecon is only investing $65 million of equity. If we were to put out a local bond for $65 million of equity in the airport project, seeing the return that it is generating, I'm certain that will be snapped up locally. But those are not even options that were considered.
You've maybe jumped ahead of my questions. That's mm-hmm. fine. It's up to me to keep my place. ACON themselves told the Toronto Star, Toronto Star, that typically tenders involving an airport with less than 1 million passengers tend to fail. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult, they said, in the airport market to tender a project on any airport that has less than 1 million passengers. Mm-hmm. Yes, you might issue a bond for $65 million, but you're not going to get any other investors to be interested in this. Mm-hmm. So how would you actually raise the money?
And here's the thing, that's their view. But just to be clear, that's their view. Mm-hmm. How do you know that view is correct? I mean, this is the same company that at the very beginning said that they would like to use the cover of a Crown corporation. This is the same company that from the very beginning has sent people to our town hall meetings and all the rest. They have a specific objective. They have PR consultants that do things. They have an objective. How do we know that? How do we know that there are not other options? How do we know that? How do we not? And so that's the thing. That is the reason why you have a tender process to ascertain. And even if at the very beginning, if we look at the things that there are, even if it was an RFI to see if there were people who may have been interested to figure out, you at least have to take that step. But you can't say that after, 18 months going through this, like, oh, you couldn't have gone to anyone else because they wouldn't be able to do it.
The Government Loans Amendment Act was passed in 2010. And August 2010. Mm-hmm. And this was apparently to confirm that government can guarantee the debts and other obligations of third parties. Now, this is in relation to the BHP board. Mm-hmm. And Kim Wilson was quoted at the time saying that if the BHP board could finance a project without the need to borrow, there'd be no need for government to guarantee the debt. Mm-hmm. And again, she's quoted, the scenario kicks in only in circumstances where the Bermuda Hospitals Board has to borrow money. If they have to borrow money, government will guarantee that. Mm-hmm. Now, as a layman, that looks to me to be extremely similar to the revenue guarantee scheme that government's promised ACON.
Mm-hmm. No, it is not the exact same. The revenue guarantee scheme, the issue with the hospital is that's just guaranteeing the debt.
But if they haven't got the revenue that can pay off the debt, then the government will kick in.
Yes, but remember, understand, the BHP is a government organization. Mm-hmm. So the BHP is not making a profit, and the profit that the BHP is making doesn't go to anyone else except for the people of this country. If we're talking about in the aspect of the airport and the aspect of ACON, ACON is a private company. So the fact is that we're guaranteeing.
The consortium that built it was a private company.
But they're not the ones that are operating it, and they're not the ones that are paying for it. I think that is a very key distinction.
I understand, but it seems to me to be a very fine point as well.
I don't think it's fine. I don't. When you talk about the operation, when you talk about all of the revenue going to a company that they can do as they like with it, when you have a contract that is stated that the total, that everything that is geared is to make sure that the internal rate of return for the project is 16%, I think that that is a completely different aspect, and that's not what you have with the BHP. So I think that every time people want to make the comparisons to the BHP, they're missing a fundamental point. The Bermuda government operates the Bermuda Hospitals Board via
the board.
That's what it is. So it's not the same. If we had a airport authority that was running the airport as opposed to ACON, we would not be able to make the same criticisms. But this is a private company, and we must not forget that. That is going to have a contract that is saying that they are going to have a 16% internal rate of return. From the perspective of the revenue guarantee, I think that's an apt point, because one of the challenges of which we have is that we don't know exactly what this revenue guarantee looks like. Because some of the information that's been put out, even when the schedules were finally released, more than 15 months after the contract was signed, we see certain things in there, even though some of the information is outdated, but we see information that the revenue guarantee is based upon a large jump in tourists next year for the America's Cup, and then the tourists not dropping down, just continuing to increase.
Well, no, it does admit that, actually. It does take that into account, if I remember reading it.
Hold a second. It says that it's a concern, but the base revenue case model, if you see the base revenue case model, just shows going up following 2017. And that's the challenge. The challenge is that we don't know exactly what is inside this deal so that we can make an assessment as to whether or not this is the best deal for the country.
How would the PLP build it then? You said you want an airport. You admit there needs to be an airport. How would you build it? How would you finance it?
Well, there's two different options. The first option is what we've stated categorically, is that out of the priorities in the country right now, we do not believe that an airport is the biggest priority. We believe that we can make minor upgrades to our existing terminal to continue and extend its useful life while we focus money and invest it in tourism development to increase the amount of air arrivals that we have so we can better finance a new airport at the time. That is the position which we have. When it comes to an airport itself, we could do the exact same deal that Aecon is doing, because anyone, Jeremy, can raise airport departure taxes by 136%, which is what Aecon is doing. Anyone can do that and use that money to finance the construction of an airport. So let's be clear in what we're talking about in this instance. There's two things. There's a question of whether or not building an airport is a priority for the country right now, and the money and the resources which that takes, and how that airport will be built if that decision is made. The first one, we understand what our position is. Personally, I believe that the money that the government is spending on this could be better invested in making sure that our schools are up to date. I could better invest in making sure that we're investing in training and education to make sure that we're investing in the things that will actually yield long-term economic growth.
And a lot of people have said we need a new airport. Mm-hmm. But you haven't answered the question, though. Mm-hmm. How would you pay for it?
I just explained it. If we did the exact same deal that Aecon is doing right now, and if it was done through the taxpayers instead of the company making this profit of which they're making, we'd be able to save the taxpayers' money overall and still build something. And I mean, so when you look at it from that perspective, but the money has to come from somewhere.
That's really what I'm getting at. Where would the money come from?
Aecon's borrowing money too.
I know it is.
Just to be clear, so if you're building something, you have to borrow money.
Absolutely. So, which is why the revenue guarantee is so important.
The revenue guarantee is important so they can get an investment grade rating, so they can secure the debt investors that they need in order to make their profit. So let's be clear. We are giving them a revenue guarantee so that they can get the debt investors that are required, so that they can then invest the only $65 million in the project, even though the total cost of estimated cost and use of construction is $375 million. So when you take $275 million, a fifth of the money, 20%, and so that they can make a 16% return on that investment.
It doesn't strike me as being an unusual business deal, but where would you raise the money from?
Again, Jeremy, the exact same place where they raise the money from.
From the
market. You borrow the money. It's the exact same place where they're getting it from.
You would sanction the government to borrow the money?
If we did the exact same deal as Aecon is doing...
But would you do the exact same deal?
I would say that is a way of going about it. I'm not going to go into specifics, but the simple question of which you're asking, Jeremy, is Aecon is borrowing the money? We would have to borrow the money. If an airport has to be paid for, then yes, you have to borrow the money.
Well, government would borrow the money.
The government borrows the money. The airport authority borrows the money. Someone has to borrow the money, but the money would have to be borrowed.
I'm trying to pin you down to say, would you do it through an RFP? Would you do it through a PPP? Or would you do it through a government project?
Here's what I will say. I would say that if we were doing this from the very beginning, we would follow the established process of government by putting it out to an RFP in the similar way we would a hospital and figuring out how it gets done. If we were to become government tomorrow, we have this contract which has already been signed. Our view would be to put it out to a Swiss challenge to see if other persons can beat the price of which Aecon has done, and if Aecon wants to walk away from the deal at that point in time, then that's up to them. But let's be clear, they didn't walk away from the deal when it was put out to tender in Quito, Ecuador. They didn't walk away from the deal when the Supreme Court of Ecuador said that you can't be taking government funds into your thing, so we have to figure another way around it. The fact is that there has been very little competitive tension inside of this deal, and as I said, if we were to become the government tomorrow, that would be the way in which we proceed.
Would you cancel it?
I didn't say we'd cancel it.
No, I'm asking if you would.
I said exactly what we would do, Jeremy, that we would put it out to a Swiss challenge to see if someone could give us a better deal than Aecon.
And if that person gave you a better deal than Aecon, mm-hmm. and if the contract's been signed,
you go with a better deal. If it makes financial sense, you go with a better deal.
But there's a golden handcuffs contract.
The fact of the matter is, over time, this deal is going to cost the country an incredible amount of money.
Yes, but in the here and now, the longer the deal goes on, isn't there a golden handcuffs contract?
Well, they have to be reimburse for their expenses. And the fact is that that is this government that got us into that contract, a contract that is difficult to get out of. That is the one that they negotiated without a tender process and without permission from the Accountant General and where they sought retroactive permission for it. So that's that position. However, we, if we're going to go into government, have to deal with the reality of the situation. And the position of which we put forward is that we would put the project out to a Swiss challenge to find it if someone could give us a better deal.
Just going back to the hospital, mm-hmm. Would you be happy to release an unredacted version of the contract?
Absolutely.
So when can we have it?
It's not in my power to release it.
So when if it is within your power, when you're premier?
You can release it immediately.
If and when you're premier?
You can release it immediately. I don't have an issue with
that. So can we hold it to that?
Sure.
The day after the election and you win?
Whenever it is. You have to understand, it's exactly like you saw inside of our throne speech reply. I think that it is very important that you have transparency. I think that there cannot be too much transparency inside of government. I think that that makes better decisions, that makes sure better decisions are made. I think that holds leaders accountable in a better way, and I think that is something that works. So I don't have an issue. The government's saying that it's redacted. I have no idea. I've never seen the contract, so I don't know, but I have no issue with releasing those things. I don't.
You've no issue with the Auditor General investigated it?
Absolutely not. I think that that's healthy. That's the minimum extent of which you should have. But what I would also say is that if the Auditor General had an issue with it, I'm sure that at some point in time, the former ones would have commented on it. But we have to remember that the hospital deal was...
Well, the Auditor General has never actually been involved in the actual contract, have they?
What I'm saying is, if they had an issue with the way it was done, I'm certain that they would have brought it up. The challenge is, just to be clear, that was managed by an international accounting firm. I don't remember which one did, and it was given awards for the transparency and the way in which it was done. So we have to compare that project under the Progressive Labour Party, which won awards and won plaudits, to what we have right now with the One Bermuda Alliance, which has caused a lot of distress, and there's a challenge as to whether or not there's actually value for money.
I mean, I haven't. It just reminded me, I haven't actually got it with me, but mm-hmm. there was a report recently that actually said this was a model way of doing it. I mean, they might get awards, yeah.
There was what report?
There was a report about a week or so ago that I read. Somebody had sent the contract and the details out, an independent assessment.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean the airport or the airports group and all the rest?
Yeah.
They said it was, I think it was creative and resourceful. And it may be creative and resourceful. That's fine. But at the end of the day, creative and resourceful is still guaranteeing a 16% return for a project to a Canadian company, and that sees money leaving the country when those resources could be better invested here.
Okay, let's move on, because we've seen a lot of angst in the community, and we saw, you know, what happened last Friday. Thankfully, it won't happen tomorrow. Now, obviously, they've called off the House of Assembly now until, I think, February the 3rd.
Yes.
Is that a good thing to do? Because, I mean, there is some angst in the community. Does that allow for a cooling down time? Mm-hmm. Or do you see that as a kind of a moral victory?
I don't know if it's so much a moral victory. I mean, reading the Premier's statement today, it seems as though if they are intent to just, let's say we're going to do the same thing in February without realizing the challenges that we have inside of the country insofar as how are we signing up to a deal that we don't know. I think one of the biggest things is that we still do not know whether or not the deal has been completely negotiated. When we were in Parliament 2 weeks ago and the question came up, the Minister of Finance, who had given a press conference, said they're still negotiating the details. Mm-hmm. If they're still negotiating the details, how could Parliament be asked to agree to something that is still technically under negotiation? So that's the first instance. The second instance is we really don't have the full details of what it is that we're getting into. I spoke about the revenue guarantee. I spoke about the full commitments. And we still do not have an independent assessment as to the impact that this project would have on government finances. And I think if we do not have those items, it's difficult for us to make a responsible decision. It makes a mockery of the democratic process in order to do that. The Airport Authority Act says that the Good Governance Act does not apply to the procurement of the airport. That's one of the things in the provisions in there. It says that Parliament no longer has the right to approve leases, and it gives the Airport Authority, who is appointed by the Minister of Finance, the ability to enter into a contract. That, I think, when Parliament is basically giving up its very right, well, what Parliament has to do is to spend money. When Parliament is giving up its right to do that in a deal that is going to last 30 years, that will bind at least five future governments, we should know exactly what it is that we're signing up to.
Let's just move on. Again, I mentioned the question. The Premier made a press conference this afternoon, mm-hmm. and he's quoted in this story as saying that there's too much angst in the community. Mm-hmm. So go back to my original question. You don't know if it's a moral victory, but is it a good idea to actually call off the House for February the 3rd for a bit of cooling off period?
The events that took place last week in where unarmed, peaceful protesters were attacked by armed police with weapons is something that certainly has raised the temperature. Before we met with the Speaker last evening, the government had already approached the Speaker about the possibility of delaying Parliament until February. And I guess that decision goes from the fear that because of the temperature, we may see a repeat in scenes of which we saw last week Friday. And from that perspective, understanding the what we trade in Bermuda is our currency, is a stable jurisdiction and reputation, I can understand the need for that. And from that perspective, I can support it. The challenge that we have is that if the government does not take advantage of this time to do the things of which a government should be doing, and that is by making sure that both parties are comfortable with the way in which we are proceeding with the airport project, and to make sure that there is full and total transparency insofar as to what happened on Friday, they're only going to be kicking the can down the road. And that could almost inflame tensions more.
I want to come on to that later on. Mm-hmm. It's something that the Speaker's raised as well. Mm-hmm. But before that, I just want to raise this thing that the Premier is quoted as saying from this afternoon, and bear with me, I've got to read this out. Did you see the press conference?
I just took a quick read of the comments.
For the benefit of the readers, of the listeners, I'll just read this out. The crowd was not listening, he said. This is the Premier. The people there were not really listening to what was taking place. Those people who were there for a purpose were not interested, in my humble opinion, and dialogue at that time. I believe that what happened on Friday was a concerted, organised effort, taking in tactics that are not acceptable in Bermuda. And I would hope that the media would uncover some of those tactics and do the job that you typically like to do. Now, here's a nub, really. I think there were many demonstrators who came with good intent to share their point, but I think there were other demonstrators who were rallied there, who knew exactly what they were getting into, and they were advised how to act, how to conduct themselves, and those types of tactics. Mm-hmm. Now, he seems to be, and this is my interpretation, obviously, he seems to be alluding that there was an organized, tactical response to this.
Mm-hmm. I would say that the Premier is probably spending too many times with political consultants, and he's probably spending too much time with the people who advised him last week Friday that it would be okay and Bermudians would not react in a negative way if he endorsed the use of riot police against unarmed protesters.
So why do you think that he would come out? Because it's
potentially
an inflammatory comment.
It is inflammatory, and it's shocking that that's actually what was said. It's very shocking.
Why would he say that then? Because if he had nothing, because it is potentially inflammatory, mm-hmm. he would know that. He's a politician, mm-hmm. he understands. He must have a basis for it.
Whether or not he has a basis, that I cannot tell you. But the conversations of which we had with the Premier yesterday was a move to de-escalate the situation. And I think that that language is anything else but de-escalating the situation. Because at the end of the day, whether or not persons were there, they were assembled peacefully, they were nonviolent, and they were unarmed, and they were attacked by riot police who discharged weapons upon the peaceful protesters that were there. There were people that were injured, there were people that were hurt, and that is something that the Premier has to answer for. Because as I've told the Premier directly, and as in the mention with the meeting with the Speaker of the House last night, Bermuda is a small place. We know that the police were authorized to use were authorized to use pepper spray before they arrived at the protest. We know that the Premier and other ministers were aware that police support units would be sent in. The Premier is doing this nice equivocation of saying, we don't order people to go in. The police commissioner made it very clear that we don't order people. But there's a difference between ordering people and knowing what takes
place.
How
do you know they knew?
Because this is Bermuda, I know. This is Bermuda. People talk.
People do talk.
Yes. Why don't you ask the Premier yourself? I mean, the Premier...
If I had an opportunity, I would do. I mean, the Premier has been asked. He has been asked, and he's never actually said that.
Hold on a second. The Premier has asked whether or not he gave the directive. The Premier has not been asked whether or not he knew that police support units would be sent in an attempt to clear the way. That is a question, and when that question was posed... No response was given.
Nothing
to
the authorizing is two different things.
Hold on a second.
Nothing approving is two different things.
I did not say that he authorized, and I did not say he approved. To be very clear, we know the way in the command structure works, and we understand. And the police commissioner made it clear that said, "Oh well, only the police can authorize the police." But here's the thing, Jeremy: if you are faced in a situation where you understand that the actions of which you take can inflame the situation, at that point in time, as a leader of the country, you should say, maybe we should not do that. Maybe we should see if there is another way about diffusing the situation.
So why do you think he didn't? If he knew, I mean, he, by silence, you're alleging he authorized it.
Because I think that he thought that the tactics would have been successful and that the gates would have opened up and they would have been able to bust their people in as they intended to do. And I think that that was the calculation that he made as a leader of the country. And I think that that is a sad miscalculation, and it represents someone who doesn't understand the history of Bermuda and maybe not understand the people of whom he represents.
I don't think there's much contention about the fact that blocking the way for MPs and ministers to the House of Assembly is a breach of the law, the Parliamentary Act 1957. Mm-hmm. If the same thing happened again, would you condone it?
It's not a question of condoning, and I want to make that very clear. When I put out the call, we put out the call for persons to come to the House of Assembly and to protest. We said come at 9 o'clock. My understanding is when people came earlier, they showed up early, the gates of Parliament were locked, and people just started congregating outside, and that is where they started congregating. I understand last night from when I was meeting with the Speaker of the House that apparently the gates were open, and so why people stayed outside and not, that's not a question that I can answer because I didn't show up until about 9:45. What I will say is this, is that civil disobedience is something that that people have engaged in from time to time. I would always support for governments to have a responsibility to make sure that they minimize the chance for those things happening and to engage in dialogue and to have leadership in understanding the situations that people face inside the country and the angst in order to lead in a responsible fashion.
But do you think civil disobedience is a justifiable tactic?
I think history has proven that civil disobedience is. I think history has.
Because you were quoted beforehand in a statement you put out, saying the PLP knows that we want to do something about our airport, but we must make progress while obeying the law.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You think civil disobedience is justifiable, but you called for people to obey the law. They disobeyed the law.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that statement, and I'll just be very clear, because obeying the law is overall, but but obeying the law from that perspective is, must obey the law, is that we have to follow the Good Governance Act. And this airport contract was entered into in contravention of the Good Governance Act.
The airport contract is not, you can't compare that with what happened.
I'm just making sure that you understand that statement. That statement was talking about we must obey the law, and that
was... It was in the context, though, of you calling for people to come out and support the protest.
Okay.
You were in the midst of the police tactics. What was going through your head? What was going through your mind at the time?
Shock. There was nothing other than shock. When we saw the police approach the people at the gate, a lot of RMPs got between the protesters and the police in a bid to calm and de-escalate the situation. Never did we think in a million years that the police riot squad would have came in and rushed us. And it was quite shocking and surprising. We stood there because that's not healthy. And that in no way, when we talk about the police are supposed to de-escalate situation, I cannot possibly imagine who thought that that would have been a good idea to escalate the situation in any way, shape, or form. And that's the challenge which we have. And we see the results of that escalation to this day. And it's not a very good thing. So,
well, it comes back to the thing about there's a lot of angst in the community.
Well, absolutely, there's a lot of angst. But I believe that the angst could certainly have been prevented. And I certainly do not believe that there would be any way, shape, or form as much angst if, to be clear, if, to be clear, there were not riot police assaulting unarmed, nonviolent protesters. The fact is that, as you say, civil disobedience is people breaking the law. It requires people to have conviction and feeling for them to do something that they know will possibly put them in jeopardy of arrest. So we have to understand and we have to recognize those feelings, those thoughts, and those beliefs.
Do you think there'll be resignations from the police force as a result of this? Or suspensions? I mean, we haven't heard about any suspensions or anything like that.
Do you think we should have to get to the bottom of what took place, Jeremy. And until we get to the bottom of what took place, it's premature to discuss this. But what I will say is somebody must be held accountable for riot police charging unarmed, nonviolent protesters and systematically spraying the pepper spray. If you look at the video, which was done on another media site, I believe it was Io Johnson, who had a wonderful video, there's a police officer with pepper spray in two hands spraying people, and the guy, it just literally, and then you see the inspector behind points into the eyes saying, basically do that. I mean, that was a tactic to what, and what, whoever decided those tactics are acceptable and should be used needs to be held to account. That has to happen, but I will go, that's the police side. There is also the political accountability side, because if, as the leader of a country, if you knew that riot police were going to be sent on your own citizens, you, in my view, have a responsibility at that time to make a decision to say, maybe we should de-escalate, and have the judgment to say that that is probably not the direction in which we want to go.
You yourself and the Speaker, and I think your deputy, Mr. Robin, have all called for an independent inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
What would the scope of that be? Because, of course, the police mm-hmm. have their own authority, the Police mm-hmm. Complaints Authority, mm-hmm. which is independent from the police.
Mm-hmm.
So is it a question you don't trust them to do the right job, or would you want your inquiry to go further than that?
It's both. It's not whether I trust them to do the right job. It's a question of the persons who were attacked, trusting them to the right job. And there's a challenge when people say, well, the police investigating the police, you know, all the rest, the governor's calling for an internal investigation and that type of stuff. I don't think that's what's required now, because I think that there are certain things that took place between the political leadership of the country and also the police leadership of the country, and those questions need to be answered. We ourselves have put in a padded request to the Cabinet Office for phone records. We put in padded requests to the police for phone records. We know that other media organizations have put in those same requests. And what we think is necessary is for, in order for people to have calm, they have to understand what happened, and someone has to be held accountable. And I also, as I indicated, I have no issue if that is a broad scope of inquiry and to look at the actions of the opposition. I have no issue there. What we have to do is, as a country, we have to move past this point. And the only way that we're going to move past this point is if we have open and honest dialogue.
Do you think if you have that kind of open and honest dialogue, that might help calm a few nerves within the business community? Because the business community here craves stability, political, mm-hmm. regulatory mm-hmm. stability, mm-hmm. and it doesn't look like it at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
just imagine, I'm sure you can, if you're Premier, what mm-hmm. would you say to them?
I will say the exact same things that I said to them on Tuesday when I met with the leaders of ABIR, and we had a full and frank discussion on the issues of which basis. And the things that I say, as Premier, we will have a more transparent government. We'll have a government that consults, and we'll have a government that will draw upon the expertise of not only the business community but also the expertise of the other side. But what I also said is that as governments, you must take responsibility for leading the country and bringing people along with you. You have to take that as something that is necessary. A lot of times the Progressive Labour Party was criticized for backing down on things of which they thought that they should do, but there wasn't popular support for it. Well, you can understand that there was stability during that time. What is key and critical is that governments and the leadership role of which they are have to do the work to bring the populace along with them.
So who called the meeting with ABIR?
The meeting with ABIR, I had arranged a meeting with them prior. It was just coincidental that it happened on the after the process.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
I'm with you.
In terms of...
But just to be clear, we meet with ABIR regularly as far as...
I didn't know if it was a coincidence.
Yeah.
That's fine. Ewart Brown said, I think it was a former PLP party conference,
mm-hmm.
I'm calling for an organized effort to take back the government. Mm-hmm. We cannot afford to wait three more years for an election. Mm-hmm. I'm a compulsive media reader. I can't help it. Mm-hmm. I read the comments. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are suggesting that what happened last week is part of that.
Mm-hmm. People can suggest that as much as they want. I deal with the realities and the facts. I don't deal with speculation. I don't do other things. We exist inside the political realm, and from the Progressive Labour Party, our job is to go inside of Parliament, our job is to put forward things. I mean, last Friday we had an entire raft of measures that were set up to look to delay, to add transparency to the process. We were going to do a privilege motion speaking as to whether or not this is actually something that was legal. We had urgent parliamentary questions, whether or not to figure out whether the contract had actually been decided, and we'd also had our motion to refer it to the Auditor General in advance and committed to the Public Accounts Committee. So we exist inside of the political realm. There are many persons who might want to engage in conspiracy theories, but let me tell you this, Jeremy. Political parties are here to exist in order to win elections, and there should be no surprise that political parties want to use the political process in order to win, whether it's a vote of no confidence or to get to an early election. That's the way things happen.
I suppose it's how you interpret organized effort to take back government. Mm-hmm. We cannot afford to wait 3 years. Mm-hmm. I guess a lot of people are interpreting that as the kind of tactics that we saw last Friday.
Well, people can interpret that as much as they want. I don't agree. I think that the perspective of where it came from, and I don't know if that was a PLP conference or a BIU conference. I don't remember which one it was. But what I would look at it is
another
so
premier
far,
was there.
Yeah, but I would say it's so far as there needs to be unity for those persons who do not believe that the One Bermuda Alliance agenda is the best agenda for the country.
I mean, one of the fallouts that haven't really been addressed very closely is the political fallout. Mm-hmm. We've seen reports that Leah Scott and Mark Pettingill mm-hmm. are considering becoming independent MPs. Have you or anybody from the PLP been in touch with those people?
We speak to MPs in all parties at all times.
I'll rephrase the question. Have you spoken to them about becoming independent?
I'm not going to get into conversation which I've had with persons on the other side.
So you have spoken to them?
We speak. I have not spoken directly to MP Pettingill, but I speak to MP Scott on occasion, absolutely. And I think that from that perspective, we've been going back and forth on the airport. It's not for me to encourage someone to become an independent. That's their own.
It's not for you to encourage, but it's very much in your interest.
It absolutely is. But I think what's key is what we have to question right now is not what's in David Burt's interest. It's a question what's in the country's interest. And in my view, I think there's certainly some persons who, on the other side, if you were to believe the reporting from Io Johnson, that there were certain MPs that says there's no way that you're going to bust me into Parliament. And so I think that there are persons with a conscience inside the One Bermuda Alliance. There are persons who actually will tell them what they need to hear. And the question is, and anyone in a side of a political party must ask for themselves, if the people inside of this room are not listening to me, do I need to be here?
Would you be willing to pull any deals if there were three independents sitting on the back benches?
I don't know if there's a question of deals. I think that what we need in this country is stability, and I think that...
You said the political party exists to get power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes.
That's your raison d'etre. Mm-hmm,
yes.
So if you pulled a deal with the three independents, you could force a minority government, you could force a vote of no conscience.
You could force many different things, but when you go about deals, I don't like deals.
Arrangements.
I still don't like that, because I think it's very clear. Where we stand is the thing is that right now we are in the last days of an existing parliament. That's where we are. That's where things are right now. The One Bermuda Alliance's delay of parliament is almost an admission that they cannot govern the country. And I think that that's something that...
It's also an admission that they can govern the country because they understand what's happening in their perspective. They need calm.
That's fine. But just to be clear, it's also the same thing that you... that there is a challenge as to whether or not you do not feel the conditions in your country are okay enough for you to conduct business. That's perfectly fine. That's what you do very well, Jeremy. but I mean, from the perspective of where we sit, there are persons on that side who may have a different view. I think that what we need to arrive at is the best solution for the country.
But the best solution for the country, though, is presumably, from your point of view, a PLP government.
Oh, I don't even think it's a PLP government. I think that stability comes from the following of a democratic process, and that comes through an election. So in my view...
But you want to win the election.
Absolutely, you want to win the election. Absolutely, it's our plan to win the election. But I think when you're talking about deals who may force minority governments, all the rest, I think
that
our...
politics.
It absolutely
isn't
is.
You see that time and time again everywhere. Mm-hmm.
I think you do, but I think that you also have to remember that a lot of people in Bermuda are tired of politics as usual. A lot of people are. And when you get into the whole thing about, you know, deals behind doors and different things like that, it reeks of politics as usual. And I think that that can also serve to, with some persons, have them look and say, you know, do I want to support that? Is that a part of it? I think that at the end, what is the most important thing is that we go back to the polls.
So... suppose Leah Scott and Mark Bedingill will join Shawcross on the back bench as mm-hmm. independents. Mm-hmm. You would be 16 each mm-hmm. with a speaker.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Philbert has asked the speaker to step down. Mm-hmm. There'd be an awful lot of pressure from within his own party for him to step down. Mm-hmm. Would you put pressure on him to step down?
I've said publicly that I believe that the Speaker of the House should return to the PLP benches. I've said that publicly. But it's up to the Speaker of the House to feel as whether or not he wants to do that. The thing of which I've said is that the Speaker of the House sits in a very strong PLP seat. He represents PLP voters. And so from that perspective, but he's taken the Speaker's role. He's been independent. That was a choice and decision of which he's made. We will continue to encourage him. But ultimately, the decision is on him. What we have to do in the Progressive Labour Party is we have to continue to put forward our plans, put forward our policies, and hopefully take our message to the people of this country so whenever the election happens, whether it be in January or whether it be in May of 2018, we get the result that we feel is the best, and that is a Progressive Labour Party victory.
Being a PLP MP and holding the balance of power is going to put him under enormous pressure, not just from the party, but mm-hmm. from all the members as well.
I think that anyone who knows Randy Horton knows he doesn't succumb to pressure that easily.
How quickly do you think the next election, general election, will come?
I don't know how quickly the next general election will come. I think it will come, I think, as a result of what happened last Friday. I think that it would be sooner rather than later. I think that what will be the case is to whether or not it's actually... understood and learned that the government had advanced knowledge that riot police were going to be put on top of protesters. And I think that that's the key point, because I think that there will be many persons in the One Bermuda Alliance, if that knew that, would be uncomfortable.
We've got our 5-minute warning.
No problem.
There is one area I'd like to cover before we do wrap mm-hmm. up, and that's the other big story that's been going on for some time now. That's the Commission of Inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen people take the stand, as it were, making accusations that basically it's institutionally racist and it's mm-hmm. a witch hunt.
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion? What's your takeout so far from what you've seen and read about the Commission of Inquiry?
My takeout of the Commission of Inquiry is that the Commission of Inquiry was clearly something that was set up for political aims. And I have made those representations directly to the commissioners, so this should come as no surprise to them. If you're going to set up an organization that is only going to look at the past government's thing in the last year of a parliament in order to produce some type of report that hope will be damning so that you can use it inside of election fodder, it's done for political purposes. My view also is that the Commission of Inquiry exposes the weaknesses of our accountability system, and that much
the
is
civil
clear.
Service system.
The civil service accountability system, whether the parliamentary accountability system, and that is why we have put forward in our throne speech reply saying that if we are returned to government, we will implement what the Sage Commission said, which were three parliamentary bodies with oversight over government ministries, and give more teeth and a full-time person to the Public Accounts Committee. If we're continuing to get into this place where we're looking at oversight that happened 7 or 8 or 9 years later, it does not help us as a country to advance.
Because, of course, you were part of the government mm-hmm. during these years. Mm-hmm. Did you not try and alter the oversight yourself? Did you see what was happening?
Here's what I'll say. I'll put it this way. I love that people like to say I was part of the government. I was never a cabinet minister.
That's you were a junior minister.
I've got you. But just to be clear,
you were part of government.
That is a distinction. But I will always make that distinction because I've never... sat around a cabinet table, so okay. I can't say that.
But nonetheless, you were part of the inner circle.
What I can say is that during our period in time in government, in my time as junior minister, we brought in place the Good Governance Act, we brought in place the Office of Project Managed Procurement, we passed the Department of Internal Audit, we did things which were praised, just to be clear, which were praised by the members of the Commission Inquiry and also by the people who testified in the Commission Inquiry. There were reports that were done insofar as the tendering process that were done, I think, by an accounting firm, and those things were by and large reflected in the changes which were made. So I think it's a challenge to say, why didn't you do anything about it? Because we did. Now, when it comes to the issues about accountability and oversight, I can't speak to decisions that were made then. What I can speak to is what we have pledged to do if we go forward. And those are the pledges that we made to the people of this country. And unlike the One Bermuda Alliance, who made those pledges about improving government and never put them into place, we will do that.
If you become Premier, will you order a Commission of Inquiry into years prior to the current Commission? Would you order an inquiry into the UBP years?
What I think is most important...
It must be tempting for you.
Of course it is, but I mean, we have to understand, $1 million has been spent on this Commission of Inquiry. And when we look at the $1 million that has been spent, think about what $1 million could do inside this country right now for the students at TN Tatum. Think about $1 million, what can happen to our young students who are struggling with sport. Government is a question of priorities. Understood. When you hold the purse strings, you have to. So I'm not going to commit to that. What I'm going to commit to is making sure that we put the right things in place to ensure better government, better governance, and better oversight. So I'm not going to say, yes, we're going to appoint a commission of inquiry. I mean, it might be something nice and easy politically to say, but at all times you have to judge what is the best use of resources. And I think there's an argument to be made that whether it be the $1 million spent on the commission of inquiry, or it be something in the future spent, if we were to spend $250,000 each year to have enhanced oversight from Parliament, that might be a better spending of money.
Final question, because we're going to...
You're not going to ask me about Vision 2025?
We've run out of time. Maybe our next interview.
No problem.
I've got lots of questions on it. I've run out of time.
Clearly you do.
Just a final question. Mm-hmm. Season of goodwill coming up to the new year. Mm-hmm. After everything that's happened, what's your message to the country?
I think the message to the country is that we need to focus on who we are as a people and focus on unity. And I think that that's something that should certainly be heeded by the government. I think that we all have a role to play, but as I told the leaders of the international business community and the premier today, that it's a responsibility of the government to lead. The government can set the tone. It's not the opposition, it's the government's responsibility. For our families, I hope that we will spend time with one another. I hope that we will forget our challenges, of which we have, for a little bit, and at least enjoy each other's company, enjoy the spirit, enjoy giving back, enjoy making sure you participate in the various things. This weekend, my branch will be putting together gift baskets for seniors in our constituency, and we're going to hand them out. And those are the type of things I think that we should be doing over the holiday season, remembering those in the community that are certainly less fortunate, remembering those in the community who will be celebrating this Christmas without a father, without a son. And I mean, those are things, especially with someone who has a young family, the very thought of losing a child and those things, it's certainly that's something that's tragic. So we have to remember that we have challenges in this country, and at any point in time, we can use to foster any sense of unity, foster any sense of better communication, foster any sense of community, I think is a good opportunity. And we will do that in the Progressive Labour Party throughout our branches, which are doing numerous things throughout the country. We hope the One Bermuda Alliance will do the same, and we hope the people of the country will at least remember that despite the challenges which we have, there should be more that unites us than divides us.
Okay, Mr. Burt, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And to all the viewers, hope you enjoyed that. Have a Merry Christmas.
Thank you for tuning in to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com, your 24/7 Bermuda news source.